Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. This episode includes details of graphic violence against children, so please proceed with caution. These types of cases are hard for me to cover. You may have noticed I rarely cover serial killers or spree killers. I need to connect emotionally, and not just with the victims, but with the killers, because I simply need to know why. We all have an inherent need to understand why. The term senseless is often used in the press with these cases because there isn't a real reason why, at least not one we can relate to. I can delve into a killer's history and tell you what I found. Some people don't like that. They think it's somehow excusing the horror. It's not. I'm presenting the facts. And they are often depressingly common. Abusive parents, sexual molestation, head injuries, learning disabilities. The two murderers I am discussing today are no different. They had difficult and abusive backgrounds, resulting in antisocial behavior that escalated as adults. They terrorized Richmond, Virginia for 7 days, murdering at least 8 innocent people before they were caught. Robbery was the only motive found, and yet it doesn't match the brutality of the killings. This was no liquor store holdup, a split-second decision with a gun. Robbery simply isn't a good enough explanation for what these men did. The only thing we can do is face the horror, to accept that they enjoyed the terror and pain they inflicted. As the author Ken Liu wrote, "The truth is not delicate, and it does not suffer from denial. The truth only dies when true stories are untold." Welcome to episode 116, The Richmond Spree Murders. Richmond, the capital of Virginia, is one of the oldest cities in the United States. It was officially established in 1737, but its history dates back well into the 17th century. In 1607, Captain Christopher Newport led English settlers into the area that would later be known as Richmond. Newport had followed the James River from the Jamestown settlement and came across the land, where indigenous tribes of the Powhatan Confederacy already lived in the region. After learning about the geography and tribes in the area from the Powhatan, Newport became preoccupied with settling this land. In 1608, he returned to the area with 120 soldiers to begin settling the land. A year later, another 120 soldiers were sent in. The infamous Captain John Smith then arranged for the purchasing of the village owned by the Powhatan, which encompassed around 3 miles of land. Captain Smith renamed the area Nonsuch. But despite their deal to sell the land, the native people were unhappy with the English settlers living in the area and drove them out, back to Jamestown. A second attempt was made in 1610, but the settlers were again forced to abandon the fort. After a series of bloody battles between the English and Native Americans in the area, including 3 Anglo-Powhatan Wars, spanning from 1610 to 1646, with a brief 7-year period of peace in between the First and Second War, and the Jamestown Massacre in 1622. The land in Virginia was carved into specific regions that belonged to either the natives or the English. This situation lasted until the time of Bacon's Rebellion, and in 1677, the Treaty of Middle Plantation was signed by the English and leaders of several Native American tribes in the area. In 1737, Colonel William Byrd II, the son of a popular tradesman and the owner of much inherited land in the area, had the city mapped out and named Richmond, after the English city near London. The land was perfect for an established city, thanks to its falls and access to the James River, that allowed for easy trading and commerce. Later, Byrd became known as the father of Richmond. In 1775, Patrick Henry delivered the famous Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death speech at St. John's Church in Richmond, helping to solidify Virginia's part in the Revolutionary War. Trade grew quickly in the area, and after the war, Richmond became a leader in flour mills and ironworks production for Virginia. And like many port cities of the time, Richmond became a leader in the slave trade. Enslaved people were imported from Africa and were bought and sold in the same agriculture market on the Manchester docks of the James River. The center of the slave market was Shaco Bottom, a creek valley flowing into the James River. Solomon Northup, author of 12 Years a Slave, was held in Shaco Bottom in 1841 at the notorious Goodwin Slave Jail before he was transported to New Orleans in chains. A national historic site, now known as the Trail of Enslaved Africans, begins at the Manchester docks. Richmond was the largest slave market on the east coast of America from 1830 to 1860. It is estimated that 300,000 enslaved people were then sent to work in the Deep South. Richmond was second only to New Orleans during this shameful time in American history, shaping our lasting, divisive racial culture. For Black Richmonders and direct descendants of the enslaved, Shaco Bottom is a sacred place. There is an African burial ground located at 15th and East Broad Streets in the historic Shaco Bottom neighborhood, home of Richmond's original 32-block layout. It was designated as an African cemetery because it was also the site of the city gallows, where many of the members of the slave revolt of 1800 were hanged. Predictably, in April 1861, with the slave trade being the center of commerce for the state, Virginia seceded from the United States, and the city of Richmond became the Confederate capital. Throughout the Civil War, Union forces came close to taking the city several times, but was not successful until 1865. The Confederate troops burned much of the city as they retreated. Once the Civil War was over, the city of Richmond bounced back as a leader in the country, in part thanks to the streetcar and railway system that was established. The area of Jackson Ward was also erected and became the center of Black commerce, entertainment, and religion. Former enslaved people and their descendants created a thriving African-American business community, which became known as the Black Wall Street. Also serving as the center of Black entertainment in Richmond, Jackson Ward was also called the Harlem of the South. Famed performers like Ella Fitzgerald, Duke Ellington, Cab Calloway, Billie Holiday, and many more graced the stages of the Hippodrome Theater and the Deuce in Jackson Ward. A statue of Billy Bojangles Robinson dancing on a staircase is at the center of the neighborhood between Chamberlain Parkway and West Lee Street. By the 1960s, Jackson Ward was central to the civil rights movement in Richmond. White leaders of Richmond targeted Jackson Ward for redevelopment plans, destroying the historic Black social culture by leveling much of the pre-existing housing to make way for freeways, wide urban boulevards, and office buildings. After desegregation, Black Virginians moved into Richmond's other residential and business areas, marking the decline of Jackson Ward's role as the center of Black commerce and entertainment. The area was now controlled by the Richmond Housing Authority and became home to a much smaller number of housing units. Instead, it was dominated by the Richmond Coliseum and the Greater Richmond Convention Center. Towards the end of the 20th century, Richmond worked to restore the historic nature of Jackson Ward. The National Park Service helped to restore the Maggie L. Walker House. Maggie Walker was an African-American businesswoman and teacher. She was the first Black woman to charter a bank and serve as its president in the United States. Born 2 years after the Civil War ended, Maggie Walker was a remarkable woman. Joining a local council at just the age of 14, championing humanitarian causes in her hometown of Richmond, before she became a businesswoman. After being paralyzed later in life, Walker kept working, using a wheelchair, and became an icon for people with disabilities. The neighborhood around the Walker House was rezoned as a historic district in 1978, and in the 80s, historic tax credits by the federal government aided in the restoration of dozens of houses on Lee, Marshall, and Clay Streets. Residents have worked to revive the cultural character of the neighborhood. However, the effects of gentrification meant that twice as many white people now lived in the historic neighborhoods in Richmond, though demographically, Black Richmonders make up 57% of the population, with white people representing only 38%. With a population of an estimated 240,000 citizens and an active urban scene, Richmond is now a popular and modern city in Virginia. The James River flows through what is now downtown Richmond, adding beauty and excitement with recreation areas exploring the Roaring Rapids. Richmond is characterized by historical events, leaving marks on not just the city or state of Virginia, but on the shaping and history of the United States. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. On New Year's Day, 2006, a musician named Johnny Hot was walking up to his friend Brian Harvey's home with his young daughter riding on his shoulders. Brian was his old bandmate, and they had remained close friends. The Harvey family lived in the Woodland Heights district of Richmond, another historic neighborhood with tree-lined streets and views of the James River. It's a vibrant and youthful area with lots of coffee shops, restaurants, and beautiful parks. Johnny was arriving early for the chili party the Harveys were throwing to celebrate the new year. It was 1:40 p.m., and the party didn't officially start until 2. Knowing that his easygoing friends, Brian and Catherine Harvey, wouldn't mind if he was early and might welcome some help setting up, Johnny walked through the front door that had been left open. The house was quiet, which seemed odd, but as he entered the home, Johnny was greeted by a thick cloud of smoke. He ran to the kitchen, thinking the Harveys might have run out on an errand and something might be on fire on the stove or in the oven. He quickly searched the kitchen as he was calling out for the Harveys, but he couldn't find a source of the smoke. So he ran back out and yelled for a nearby neighbor to call 911. Dozens of police officers and firefighters arrived on the scene shortly after the call. Soon, all the friends of the Harveys arrived for the chili party and stood shocked, watching the fire and the first responders swarming the Harvey home. The fire department extinguished the flames quickly and immediately began searching the home, looking for any people that might have been trapped inside. One lieutenant noted that he felt more heat coming from the basement door than any other part of the house. He ran down the basement stairs, where the smoke was thick, and as he reached the bottom, he felt what he thought was a body. He saw that it was a woman, and assuming that she was suffering from smoke inhalation, he quickly carried her to the front yard to perform resuscitation measures, but made a startling discovery. There was a sock in her mouth. Initially, first responders assumed that the woman had been overcome by smoke in the basement and had attempted to cover her mouth with a sock. But then they saw that both her hands and ankles were bound together. The woman was 39-year-old Catherine Harvey. As the EMTs realized it was too late to save Catherine, the crew inside kept searching the basement for the rest of the Harvey family. To their horror, they found the body of 4-year-old Ruby Harvey, whose ankles and hands were bound with tape, just like her mother's. As they realized they were actively searching within a crime scene, the firefighters halted their efforts and walked back out, trying not to further disturb the scene. Then police investigators and the medical examiner on the scene entered the home. Ashes from the fire covered the floor and surfaces of the basement, with soot powdering the walls. In the corner of the room was a child's play area with puzzles, toys, and a puppet theater. Next to the play area, they discovered the body of 49-year-old husband and father, Brian Harvey. His limbs were bound in a hogtied position. Off to another corner in the basement was a futon, and lying underneath was the Harvey's 9-year-old little girl, Stella. Like the rest of her family, her hands and ankles had been bound. With smoke still hanging in the air, investigators began to search through the debris for any weapons that could have been used in the horrendous attack. During this search, two hammers lying side by side and two knives were found. Empty wine bottles, which investigators thought might have been used as accelerants for the fire, were also found. There was no sign of a break-in, but according to Johnny Hott, the front door was already open when he arrived. The side door to the home was also unlocked, and several items were missing from the house, including jewelry worn by the victims. Brian and Catherine's wedding bands were ripped right from their fingers. The medical examiner on the scene, Dr. Darren Trelka, assessed the bodies. He noted that the wife and mother, Catherine Harvey, had sharp force injuries consisting of stab and incised wounds to her neck. He was later interviewed for an episode of the show Wicked Attraction about this case, and he chokes up on camera, still struggling to speak of the horrors done to the Harvey family. Ruby, the youngest Harvey daughter, also had sharp force injuries to her throat. Dr. Trelka noted that Brian was struck 6 times in the head and had 8 slices across his neck that resembled a sawing motion. Stella, like the rest of her family, had endured similar injuries. During his full examination, Dr. Trelka would find that Stella had still been alive as the house burned. Her cause of death was listed as smoke inhalation and blunt force trauma to the head. The entire Harvey family had suffered stab and incised wounds and were bound, beaten, and bludgeoned. A Richmond detective working the case named Lisa Beatles told the news station NBC 12 about the scene she witnessed at the Harvey home. She said, quote, "Firemen and police were supposed to be tough-skinned superheroes. I saw people that I knew for 20 years sitting on a fire truck with tears running down their face." The Harvey family was well known in their neighborhood of Woodland Heights and in the greater city of Richmond. Catherine and Brian were married there on December 1st of 1990. At the time of their deaths, they had been married for 15 years and had 2 beautiful daughters. 9-year-old Stella Ann was born first in November of 1996. Stella's little sister, 4-year-old Ruby May, was born in July of 2001. Brian Tabor Harvey, born in Danville, Virginia in April of 1956, was a talented musician. At 49 years old, he still had such a youthful spirit. Brian was a singer and guitarist in the band Energy Crisis, a popular act around the city, and he worked on computers for the Henrico County school system during the day. Catherine Elizabeth Harvey, maiden name Grabinski, was born in Norfolk, Virginia in November of 1966, but grew up in the Virginia Beach area before coming to Richmond. The 39-year-old mother was known as a lovely and vivacious woman. She was part owner of a whimsical children's toy shop named World of Mirth. People in Richmond regarded the quirky store as a local favorite. The Harveys were artistic and athletic, an energetic and fun-loving family. They were dearly loved by their friends, family, and community, who spoke of the devotion and happiness that Brian and Catherine shared with their 2 little girls. Johnny Hott, their friend, who was first to arrive at the scene, was the first potential suspect in the murders because he was first on the scene. There was no sign of forced entry, and the location of the bodies stood out to police. They learned from friends and family that the Harveys frequently hung out in the basement together, playing with their girls. This suggested to investigators that the perpetrator might have been someone the family knew. Johnny Hott and Brian Harvey were close friends and former bandmates. They had performed as a group called House of Freaks. Despite Brian's new group, Energy Crisis, the pair stayed close, always socializing with each other's families. They had gone Christmas caroling together that holiday season before the murders. Their old band, House of Freaks, put out 5 albums before they broke up. And one of their songs caught the attention of police and cast more doubt onto Johnny. The song described a heartbroken woman in a basement. It spoke of a knife, pain, and the concept of mercy. Police questioned and investigated Johnny Hott and his relationship with the Harvey family throughout the week following the murders. During his long interrogations, Johnny explained to the investigators that Brian had actually written the song they had found to be disturbingly similar to the murder scene. Detectives were soon convinced that Johnny simply had the misfortune of happening upon the scene before any of the other partygoers. They announced to the public, who anxiously awaited an arrest in the case, that Johnny Hott had been cleared. Once Johnny had been cleared, police feared that multiple suspects could still be lurking around Richmond. Fear gripped the city. And it wasn't until a call from 911 came in that investigators made a break in the case. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from today's sponsors. I love to cook, but I detest grocery shopping. I can never stick to a list, and I hate lines. But I found a solution with EveryPlate. You can get meals you'll enjoy and your bank account will love, delivered contact-free right to your door. EveryPlate dinners are also a less expensive and more fulfilling alternative to takeout or delivery. You definitely get more bang for your buck. With easy-to-follow recipes and pre-portioned ingredients, you spend less time in the kitchen and more time enjoying a delicious meal with your family. And with a weekly changing menu of 14 recipes a week, you get so much to choose from. My family and I devoured the Mushu beef bowls this week for dinner. It's one of our favorite recipes. At first, I thought meal kits would be too expensive for my family, but I soon found that EveryPlate is affordable. I get the same deliciousness for a much lower price. Try EveryPlate for just $1.99 per meal, plus an additional 20% off your next 2 boxes by going to everyplate.com and entering the code SOUTHERNFRIED199. That's everyplate.com and enter the promo code SOUTHERNFRIED199 for a $1.99 meal with an additional 20% off your next 2 boxes. Is there something bothering you? I know sometimes my anxiety can make me just freeze up. It interferes with my productivity. BetterHelp Online Counseling is there for us. They will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. BetterHelp has over 3,000 licensed therapists in all 50 states, treating depression, anxiety, stress, trauma, grief, and other issues that so many of us suffer from. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they are recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. The service is also available to clients worldwide. From your phone, laptop, or tablet, you can connect with a professional counselor via text, chat, phone, or video, and start communicating with your counselor in under 24 hours. You can send a message to your counselor at any time. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses, and you can schedule weekly sessions with your counselor by video or phone, whichever makes you feel more comfortable. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so it is easy and free to change counselors if you want to, and anything you share is confidential. BetterHelp is more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and there is even financial aid available. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/southern. Join over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp, HELP.com/southern. The 911 call came from a woman who was concerned about a friend that she had been unable to reach for the better part of a day, now 6 days after the Harvey murders. The friend was Ashley Baskerville, a 21-year-old woman who had been staying with a 911 caller for a couple of days, along with 2 older men. The woman told the dispatcher that she was worried for Ashley's safety. She felt uneasy about the 2 men she was with and suspected they might have had something to do with the murders. She recalled that all three of them had been acting strange following the murders, and that the men had made troubling remarks when the news broke that the bodies of the family had been found. These men were 29-year-old Ricky Gray and his nephew, 29-year-old Ray Dandridge. Police made a trip to the 911 caller's home to speak with her and found items in the home that were brought in by Gray and Dandridge. The police believed that these items connected the men to the Harvey murders. Concerned about Ashley Baskerville's safety, the police hurried to her home, where she lived with her mom and stepfather, Purcell and Mary Tucker. The Tucker home was in a part of Richmond, far removed from the high-end neighborhood of Woodland Heights, where the Harvey home was. When officers arrived at the home, they found an all-too-familiar and jarring scene. There in the home were the bound, beaten, sliced, and suffocated bodies of 21-year-old Ashley, her 47-year-old mother Mary, and her 55-year-old stepfather Purcell. Purcell was found in the living room. He had been stabbed 5 times in the neck and had duct tape covering his face from his chin to his nose. Mary's body was found in the master bedroom. She had suffered 2 stab wounds to the neck and had duct tape from her chin all the way to her eyes. Ashley's body was located in her bedroom on the floor. Like her parents, her neck had been sliced and she had duct tape from her chin to her nose. But she also had a shopping bag taped around her head. All of the victims had their limbs bound. It was evident to the medical examiner, Dr. Darren Trelka, that the three had suffered a long and cruel death, as they suffocated rather than succumbing to their many stab wounds. Purcell and Mary Tucker had been together for over 19 years. They had met when Ashley, Mary's daughter, was 2 years old. Purcell was described by family as a quiet man who worked as a forklift driver, but he had a real passion and talent for baking. Mary was a devoted churchgoer and was part of a missionary society where she made regular visits with the elderly. They lived in the Swansboro neighborhood in Richmond. The area was known for crime, but the Tuckers had built a life there, and the couple was loved and admired by friends despite their daughter's problematic behavior. Ashley's issues started early. By the age of 10, friends of the family say Ashley was running with a dangerous crowd. It was then, according to family members, that Ashley began doing drugs. And eventually, she graduated to selling drugs. By the age of 12, her parents were at a loss of how to reason and get through to their daughter, and they made the difficult decision to turn her over to the Virginia Department of Child Services. From there, she spent her teenage years in and out of different shelters and treatment programs before being jailed just 2 months after her 18th birthday. Immediately, police noticed the similarities between the victims at the Tucker home and the scene at the Harveys. Bindings were used on all 7 victims, and the medical examiner confirmed that the stab wounds and slashes to Purcell, Mary, and Ashley's necks were very similar to Brian, Catherine, Stella, and Ruby's wounds. Despite this, there were differences. First, the homes were located in much different neighborhoods, with the Tuckers living in a high crime area in comparison to the Harveys' upscale neighborhood. Second, the scene at the Tuckers had been way more messy, indicating more of a struggle. And of course, the Harveys were white and the Tucker family was black. But investigators soon found an item that proved the two attacks were related. On a chain around the neck of 21-year-old Ashley Baskerville, they found the gold wedding band that was missing from Brian Harvey's ring finger. Continuing to work off the lead from the 911 caller, police knew they had to locate the men who had recently been seen with Ashley, Ricky Gray, and Ray Dandridge. Mary and Purcell Tucker's car, a Chevrolet Trailblazer, was missing from their home. the police released photos of Ricky and Ray, along with a picture of the missing vehicle. As the photos were circulated through the media, police received a call from an elderly man named Roy Mason. Mason described to police how 2 days after the Harvey murders, he was the victim of a home invasion and robbery. According to Mr. Mason, Ricky Gray, Ray Dandridge, and Ashley Baskerville forced their way into his home after pretending to ask for directions, and then threatened to kill him and his sickly wife. He explained that during the robbery, Ashley fully participated, taking a gaming console from the home and rummaging through their belongings. Despite fearing for his life, Mr. Mason pleaded with the thieves to spare him so that he could care for his sick wife. Showing mercy they hadn't given to the Harveys, the three perpetrators took their spoils and fled the home, leaving Roy Mason and his wife alive. Because of her connection to the suspects, police persuaded the female 911 caller to call Ray Dandridge's phone, hoping he would let on to where he and his uncle were, presumably hiding out. Ray answered her call and admitted that things had gotten bad. While he talked, police were able to trace the cell phone to a home more than 250 miles away in Philadelphia. Richmond police coordinated with Philly detectives to surveil the home. They spotted Purcell and Mary Tucker's missing trailblazer parked outside of the home, which belonged to Ray's father. By 8:30 the next morning, a SWAT team was positioned outside of the home. Once they entered, Ray Dandridge was arrested as he attempted to exit through the back door. Members of the SWAT team searched the rest of the home for Ricky Gray. They found him hiding in the basement behind a furnace, wielding a power drill. Gray resisted arrest, fighting wildly. The SWAT team worried he was trying to go out as suicide by police. But they were able to subdue him without injury and took him and his nephew in for questioning. Going to pause now to hear a final word from today's sponsors. For me, the only thing I like about cold weather is curling up on my couch with a cozy blanket and my dog snoring next to me as I find my next show to binge watch from across the pond. I just love to lose myself in another world with beautiful accents. That's why I have Acorn TV. Acorn TV is a commercial-free streaming service that's rooted in British television that can take you to Ireland, Australia, and beyond, all for the unbeatable price of $5.99 a month. All the series you will find on Acorn TV are so cleverly written and visually striking. And Acorn TV has it all, from top-rated mysteries, addictive dramas, and heartwarming comedies. My favorites are the suspenseful crime dramas, like the Acorn TV original Mystery Road. The second season of the show that the New York Times called a visual knockout just premiered. Mystery Road is set in the stunning Australian outback, where a local cop, played by Oscar nominee Judy Davis, teams up with a hot detective to investigate the mysterious disappearance of two boys. But solving that case could expose other crimes that haunt the town. Aside from Mystery Road, I'm obsessed with Murdoch Mysteries, set in 1895, as well as the addictive British comedy drama Agatha Raisin. With Acorn TV, you get thousands of hours of new, refreshing content at a fraction of the cost of most streaming services for just $5.99 a month. Escape to Britain and beyond without leaving your seat. Try Acorn TV free for 30 days by going to acorn.tv and use my promo code SOUTHERNFRIED. That's ACORN.TV, code SOUTHERNFRIED, to get your first 30 days for free. I love to cook. It's my zen time. I catch up on podcasts and zone out. That's why I'm so excited about our new partner, Green Pan. Since 2007, millions of people around the world have joined the Green Pan revolution. Green Pan's founders discovered that traditional nonstick pans were made with plastic coatings that can turn toxic with heat. So they set out to make a new alternative. Green Pan invented the ceramic nonstick cookware category and are pioneers in creating cookware without harmful toxins like cadmium and lead. bread. Ceramic does not emit fumes when it's cooked. It conducts heat evenly and is super easy to clean. It also takes much less oil or butter, so your meals are healthier. GreenPan also has Scratch Guard reinforced surface technology, a double exterior with an oven-safe handle, and it's good for the environment. GreenPan emits 60% less CO2 during the production process at their solar-powered factory. They have full sets, frying pans, grill pans, woks, pots, and accessories with tons of different collections to choose from. And their site has a huge number of great recipes as well. We just got our Green Pan Reserve open fry pan set, and I have to say, I can already see a huge difference. I love the design and colors, as well as the peace of mind knowing I'm not cooking with harmful chemicals. And with less oil and sticking, it just cooks my food better. Remember, healthy cooking is more than about just the food you cook. It's also the products you cook with, too. Right now, they have an exclusive offer just for Southern Fried listeners. If you go to greenpan.us and use the promo code Southern Fried, you'll receive 30% off your entire order plus free shipping on orders over $50. Whether you buy one pan or a whole set, that's 30% off. So go to greenpan.us and use our promo code Southern Fried. Ricky Javon Gray was born in 1977 in Arlington, Virginia. At an early age, Ricky was labeled as a hyperactive, disruptive troublemaker. He struggled in school, likely in part due to his difficult home life. His father physically and verbally abused Ricky from an early age, and he was molested by his stepbrother. This abuse would last for years. Ray Joseph Dandridge, like his uncle, struggled academically, and he was also diagnosed with a learning disability. Though any history of child abuse was not reported. A forensic psychologist would later describe Ray Dandridge as socially inept and a slow learner. In essence, he was a follower, easy manipulated by someone he looked up to. Ricky and Ray spent a lot of time together growing up. Even though Ricky was Ray's uncle, the men were born the same year and had always been close. Ray Dandridge's father told the Richmond Times-Dispatch about the dynamic between his son and Ricky, quote, "When he was young, I told him to leave that boy alone and stop hanging around with him and stuff. It seemed like he was always getting in trouble when he was around." Ricky Gray was definitely the more dominant of the two, usually leading the pair into schemes he had planned. In their late teens, they both wound up in prison. Both Ray and Ricky were arrested in 1995 for a series of armed robberies in Northern Virginia and the D.C. area. Ray was released after 3 years. But after those 3 years, he was soon arrested again on federal drug charges. This time, Ray assisted investigators in another case in exchange for a 5-year sentence. By January of 2005, Ricky Gray was again a free man. Following his release, Ricky hooked up with a woman he had known before the time of his arrest, named Treva Terrell. According to a report from the Richmond Times-Dispatch, the two began a romantic relationship, and Ricky quickly moved in with Treva in her Pennsylvania home, despite the protests from her parents, Marna and John Squires. 3 months later, in April of 2005, Ricky Gray and Treva Terrell were married. Ricky tried some straight jobs for a while. He worked as a telemarketer and got his electrician's license. But he couldn't adjust to a normal life outside of prison. According to his mother-in-law, Marna, Ricky always seemed like he was waiting for someone to attack. He was just on edge all of the time, she said. It wasn't long after their marriage that Treva confided to her mother that she was unhappy with Ricky and said the relationship was basically over. Treva wanted her new husband gone and said she was going to kick him out of her house. But around this time, in October of 2005, Ray Dandridge was released from prison for the federal drug charges. Unsurprisingly, the first place he went was Pennsylvania in search of his uncle. Ricky and Ray had not seen each other since the time of their arrest and trials for the robberies. Treva agreed to let Ray stay with them as he sorted his life out, a decision that would forever haunt her family in the following years. Around November 1st, 2005, Treva went missing. Her husband, Ricky Gray, began incessantly calling her mother, asking if she knew where her daughter was. 5 days after she went missing, Treva's body was found, strangled and beaten, underneath a tree next to a used car lot. After the discovery of their daughter's body, Marna and John Squires threw Ricky and Ray out of Treva's home. They had become suspicious when they noticed red scratch marks on Ray's forearms. Investigators questioned each of the men several times, but were not able to make a case against either of them. Ray left the area to stay with his father in Philadelphia, and Ricky fled to Virginia, where he stayed with his aunt for a time. The pair would not reunite until Christmas night, just a week before the Harvey murders, when Ray Dandridge left Philadelphia to meet up with Ricky in Virginia. Once they were in custody under suspicion for the Harvey and Baskerville Tucker murders, Ray Dandridge implicated his uncle as the leader in the home invasion schemes. Both men ended up confessing to the crimes fairly quickly, in a cold, matter-of-fact manner. They said that in early November of 2005, Treva and Ricky Gray had been arguing about their marriage. As the fight escalated, Ricky instructed Ray to hold Treva down as he choked her and beat her with a lead pipe. Ricky Gray chillingly said he killed his new bride because he had simply gotten tired of her. After they killed her, Ricky and Ray dumped Treva's body on the side of the road near the used car lot. 2 months later, on New Year's Eve, Ricky and Ray were cruising around town looking for someone to rob. At around 8:30 p.m., they spotted a man named Ryan Carey walking along the street. Ryan cooperated with the men, quickly handing over his wallet, but Ricky and Ray brutally attacked him anyway. It was so vicious that they broke off 2 knives in his body. Ryan Carey was hospitalized for 2 months after the attack and spent 2 weeks in a coma. He did survive, but the savage attack would cause him to lose all use of his right arm and leave his body horribly scarred. The next day, Ricky and Ray contacted Ray's pen pal from prison, a girl named Ashley Baskerville. Ashley had just spent time in prison herself in March of 2005. She and Ray had flirtatiously corresponded throughout their time of incarceration. But once she met up with Ray and his uncle Ricky, she began a romantic relationship with Ricky instead. While prowling around the Woodland Heights area of Richmond and looking for a house to target, they came across the Harvey home. New Year's Eve had been much different for the Harvey family. Brian Harvey headed to a New Year's Eve event at the Doubletree Hotel, where he and his band Energy Crisis put on a show for a crowd of about 150 partiers. Catherine and her daughter Ruby spent the night at home having a quiet night in, while her other daughter Stella was at a New Year's Eve sleepover with a friend. At about 2 in the morning, Brian arrived home after playing a 4-hour set with his bandmates, and he was looking forward to the party they had planned for New Year's Day. As they prepared for the party the next day, running items in and out of their home, the Harveys left their front door open. Sometime after 9 a.m., Ricky, Ray, and Ashley were prowling the neighborhood and noticed the open door to the family's home. They decided this was the house they were going to rob. Ashley remained in the car to serve as lookout while Ricky and Ray went into the home. As they stormed into the house, wielding weapons, the men assured Brian and Catherine that as long as they got what they wanted and everyone stayed calm, that no one would get hurt. So the Harveys cooperated with the men. The men ushered Brian, Catherine, and Ruby into the basement, where Ricky tied up Brian as Ray went upstairs to search the house for items to steal. A knock on the front door caught the robbers off guard. It was around 10 a.m., and their friend had arrived to drop off the Harveys' oldest daughter, Stella, from her New Year's Eve sleepover. Catherine, led by Ricky at knife point, went up the stairs to get her daughter. The family friend noticed that Catherine was acting odd, but when she asked if everything was all right, she said Catherine put her hand to her temple and just said she wasn't feeling well. Before leaving, the woman told Catherine she would see her later at the party, and Stella ran into the home. After being startled by the interruption, the men tied up Catherine and her daughters as well. And then Ricky and Ray pounced, viciously attacking the family, using knives and hammers to stab and beat each of the Harveys. When they were finished, they stripped Brian and Catherine of their jewelry, grabbed a couple of laptops, and took it all out to the car. They even snagged a basket of freshly baked cookies from the kitchen. After going back to the basement, Ricky discovered that the little girls were still alive. He took a hammer and bludgeoned them both again. Then Ricky and Ray used wine they found in the house as an accelerant and set the house ablaze, spreading most of the wine in the basement where the Harveys' bodies were found. During their confessions, the men admitted that they had also robbed Roy Mason and his wife 2 days later. They said that after this robbery, Ashley suggested her own parents' home as the next target, specifically her stepfather. They planned to use Ashley as a prop in their robbery of the Tucker home. At least, that's what Ricky and Ray told her. Ashley gave them a key to the house, and then they taped her hands and mouth up. They invaded the home in the middle of the night, with Ashley pretending to be shocked and scared, playing along. She didn't know that Ricky and Ray were also planning to kill her. Ricky stabbed Mary Tucker before wrapping her and Purcell Tucker's face with duct tape and plastic wrap. To Ashley's horror, Ricky then stabbed her and taped a bag over her head. He would later tell police that things just got out of hand at the Tucker house, and also that he was tired of Ashley, so he decided to kill her too and steal her parents' car. Based on their confessions and evidence linking them to the scenes, prosecutors charged each man with the killing of one family. Ricky Gray with the Harveys and Ray Dandridge with the Baskerville Tuckers. Ricky was charged with 5 counts of capital murder in the Harvey killings, 1 charge for killing more than once in a 3-year period, 1 charge for committing more than 1 killing in a single act, 1 charge for killing in commission of a robbery, and 2 charges for killing a child under 14 years of age. On the same day, Ray Dandridge was charged with 3 counts of capital murder in the Baskerville Tucker killings. A 3rd count was later amended to include his role in the Harvey killings. It seems odd, but the Commonwealth probably wanted to ensure convictions in both of the family murders first, making sure that Ricky, the ringleader, was either put to death or got life in prison. If Ricky's first trial was unsuccessful, he could then be tried for the Baskerville Tucker murders. Ricky Gray faced his trial first on August 17, 2006. Despite his confession, he still pled not guilty. His attorneys acknowledged during the trial that he had confessed to the murders. They did not contest any of the information established in the proceedings, and they did not call any witnesses to the stand. They really didn't have any other strategy unless they wanted to attempt a diminished capacity or insanity defense. An article in the local newspaper noted that throughout the trial, Ricky Gray never showed any remorse or empathy in the courtroom, even as he was described by the prosecutors as a cold-blooded killer. Newspapers reported about how the Harvey family was massacred and how Ricky had savagely murdered 4-year-old Ruby and 9-year-old Stella. One juror was in tears, and most of the other jurors were visibly shaken. The jury deliberated for just 30 minutes before returning a guilty verdict, and they recommended the death penalty. At his sentencing 2 months later in October, Ricky Javon Gray received a life sentence in prison for the murders of Brian and Catherine Harvey, and death by lethal injection for the killing of their daughters, Stella and Ruby. Ray Dandridge's trial took place a month after his uncle's in September of 2006. He also pled not guilty. During the trial, the prosecutor wound a roll of tape around a cardboard tube as he described how Ray Dandridge wrapped the victims' faces, quote, again and again. This graphic display caused family members and loved ones of the Baskerville Tuckers to leave the courtroom. Jurors also listened to a recorded call that Ray Dandridge had made to a girlfriend from jail. He had described the brutal slayings in the Tucker home in detail. A forensic scientist testified that DNA consistent with Ray Dandridge's was found on the duct tape at the scene. Finally realizing he was facing the death penalty, Ray made a last-minute plea deal. He pled guilty and was sentenced to life in prison. Despite their confessions, and to the disappointment of Marna and John Squires, the parents of Treva Terrell Gray, neither man was charged with her murder. The husband who killed her was sent to death row, and his accomplice was sentenced to life in prison. But Treva's parents, understandably, still wanted a trial for their daughter's murder. On September 26, 2006, both Gray and Dandridge pled guilty to the aggravated malicious wounding of the 26-year-old man named Ryan Carey, the young man they had jumped on New Year's Eve. Each was sentenced to an additional 25 years in prison for the ruthless attack. For many years, Ray and Dandridge were considered suspects in the December 18, 2005 murder of a Culpeper County, Virginia resident named Cheryl Warner. Cheryl was a legal secretary, divorced, and the mother of three children. She had celebrated her 37th birthday the week before her murder. She had been on the phone with her father when a man knocked on the door, claiming that he needed help because his car had broken down. This sounded similar to how Gray and Dandridge had gotten into the Mason home, the elderly couple they had allowed to live. Cheryl's father said she told him she had to go, but promised to call him right back. When he hadn't heard from his daughter within the next hour, he called the police. When two officers arrived at the scene, they found the house on fire, and once the flames were put out, they discovered Cheryl hanging from the basement ceiling. She had been shot in the head. Ricky Gray was even indicted for the murder in 2008, but the charges were dropped when investigators found that his cell phone was active in Pennsylvania that night, during the time of the murder. The murder is similar to the Richmond Spree killings, except for the use of a gun. It's possible that Ray acted alone in this murder, or that Ricky left his cell phone with someone in Pennsylvania. But we can't know. Cheryl's murder remains unsolved. An inmate at Northern Neck Regional Jail in Warsaw claimed to be friends with Ashley Baskerville. He told investigators that Ashley had described Cheryl's murder to him. And the police claimed that this inmate knew details that were not released to the public, including that Cheryl's front yard was fenced and that she had a dog. The inmate said that Ashley told him that Ricky Gray had a gun, and after he killed Cheryl, she went down to the basement and saw her body hanging from electrical cords. Ashley told her friend that she and Ricky had followed Cheryl home from a gas station, and then Ricky knocked on her door saying his car was broke down before forcing his way in. But with the cell phone evidence disputing Ricky's whereabouts at the time of Cheryl's murder, the testimony of a prison inmate didn't hold much water. It is still compelling, though, considering the details he knew. In 2017, a video was released by Virginians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty showing Ricky Gray apologizing for the deaths of the Harvey family, a stark difference to his demeanor in the courtroom back in 2006. In the video, a remorseful-seeming Ricky Gray says, "I've stolen something from the world." The 18-minute video was used by his attorneys in an effort to seek clemency. It also examined the impact of the severe childhood sexual abuse Ricky had suffered, which the group argued that the jury had never heard any testimony detailing the abuse or about Ricky's abuse of drugs, which they said stemmed from the years of abuse. Ricky also claimed to have been high on PCP at the time of the murders. His last appeal was denied by the Supreme Court just hours before he was put to death by lethal injection on January 18, 2017. Ricky declined his right to a last meal, and when asked if he had any last words, he replied with a simple, "Nope." Ray Dandridge remains incarcerated, serving his life sentence out at the Sussex II State Prison in Virginia. He is now 43 years old. According to the Richmond Times-Dispatch, during the funeral for the Harvey family held at the Byrd Theater, Brian Harvey's old bandmates joined together to sing one of his songs, titled "Remember Me Well." These lyrics rang out as their loved ones tried to process the lives that had been stolen from them. "When I'm gone from this world, please remember me well. You can dance on my grave, you can ring out the bells. After all's said and done, please remember me well." The Brian and Catherine Harvey Family Memorial Endowment was created to provide music, visual art, and performing arts enrichment in the Richmond area. Several different memorials were dedicated to the family around Richmond and to the little girls individually at the schools they attended. The heinous spree murders committed by Ricky Gray and Ray Dandridge over the course of 1 week has left a permanent scar on Richmond and on the lives of the residents there, especially in the small communities of Woodland Heights and Swansboro, where the families had lived. Ricky Gray did suffer a cruel childhood of physical and sexual abuse, but he and Ray took the lives of at least 8 people, including 2 innocent little girls, for nothing more than some cash jewelry and, sickeningly, a basket of warm cookies. Ray Dandridge didn't exactly have the same terrible childhood Ricky did, but he had a learning disability and poor social skills, leaving him easily manipulated by his dominant uncle. But I don't think that's a good enough excuse for the carnage he was also responsible for. As for Ashley Baskerville, she didn't actively participate in the Harvey murders, but she was certainly a part of all of it. She cruelly served up her mother and stepfather on a platter for Ricky and Ray, never dreaming these vicious killers would also turn on her. As I said in the opening, these types of cases, spree killings, are so difficult to understand. The killings are cold, impersonal, and brutal, all for supposedly a little cash, jewelry, and other small items. To me, author Clive Barker has a way of seeing into the minds of killers like these. He wrote, "Behind their eyes, the hope was sickening and in many dead. They lived from event to event with a subtle terror of the gap between, filling up their lives with distractions to avoid the emptiness where curiosity should have been." Ricky Gray and Ray Dandridge were simply evil, devoid of feeling. They were empty. And they cut a path of destruction through Richmond, cruelly snuffing out 8 lives. Southern Fried True Crime is produced by me, Erica Kelly. Today's episode was researched and written by me and Hannah Newcomb. The audio is edited and mixed by Ches Gray of Gray Multimedia. Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio, and the original graphic art is by Coley Horner. If you're not already a member, come join my Facebook group. While we do discuss crime, we also share memes and have a lot of laughs. We worship our patron saint, Dolly Parton, and our motto is "No Shit Asses Allowed." If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher and Spotify, as well as Stitcher Premium, where you can listen ad-free. If you have any case suggestions, please email southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I do not accept suggestions on social media private messages, but please feel free to reach out by email. Not only do I get my most interesting and little-known cases from listener suggestions, I love hearing from you guys. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.